Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am happy to bring the conversation I had with Christopher Liddell. Chris has led many senior roles in politics, private sector, and philanthropy. He was the White House Deputy Chief of Staff during the Trump administration and has been involved in three presidential transition cycles. He's in the private sector. He was the Chief Financial Officer of several major companies, such as Microsoft and General Motors. He has a Bachelor's of Engineering from Auckland University, Master's of Philosophy from the University of Oxford, and he is the author of the new book, Year Zero, The Five-Year Presidency, and that is what we talk about. We talk about what is Year Zero and why presidential transitions are important. We talk about the massive endeavor of filling the U.S. government of all the positions that are needed. We talk about the design, plan, and execution phases of Year Zero. We talk about his work on the Romney transition, which obviously didn't happen in terms of Romney becoming president, but he did work on all of the, I think it's 6 to 8 months of the transition process. It's kind of like the first time he implemented some of these strategies, and it was quite remarkable to see what he was trying out and how he was able to do things, even though it was not for Romney to be president. We talk about his work with the Trump transition and then from Trump into Biden. So he's worked on three different kinds of transition periods. We talk about standardization, flexibility with different presidents. We talk about having an office of president of the United States, why there should probably be a first 200 days. We, of course, talk about the current 2024 presidential election and many more topics. Chris is great. He's absolutely a wonderful person. Super smart, really, really good administratively. He can see big picture, can look at how to organize things for so many big systems. I found this such an important conversation to have, why we need him and folks like him to really be thinking about these things to just make systems run much better. So it's all very wonderful in that way. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at Converging Dialogues at Substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. So get over there, like, subscribe, follow, share with your friends. And now I bring you Chris Liddell. I am here with Chris Liddell. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to speaking with you.
Hey, it's a real pleasure to be on. Thanks for having
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. As I was saying before we got on, I had a podcast maybe about a year or so ago with Dave Marchek, who wrote a book based on his podcast about presidential transitions. Dave's a great guy. Everyone should listen to that episode and follow his work. And you were mentioned in that podcast, and it was wonderful to get everything coordinated and to actually get your voice on here to talk about all of your wonderful work that you've been doing over the past couple of years. So we're going to talk all about your book, Year Zero, The Five-Year Presidency, which is fantastic. But before we do, why don't you tell listeners just a snapshot of, you know, who you are professionally or, you know, academically, or what you're currently up to at the moment?
Sure, thanks. So I come from New Zealand originally. You can probably hear a little bit of an accent there. And I've been here in the States for around 20 years now. I came over transfer with the company that I was working for at the time, International Paper. To be their chief financial officer. And then I was CFO of a couple of other companies, which you might have heard of, Microsoft and General Motors. So I worked in the private sector most of my life, mainly as chief financial officer, but a few other things as well. Then I've been mostly involved in politics for around the last 10 years. I worked on the Romney campaign, which we might talk about a little bit later, and then have spent 4 years in the Trump White House. So I was probably one of the longest serving assistants to the president, because I was there from the very first minute to the very last. I left at 11:59 on January 20th. So I'm sure we'll talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. And then since that time, since I left the White House on January 20th, 2021, I've been working on this book. I'm doing a doctorate at the moment in politics and history.
Nice.
And I'm doing some private sector work. And then I'm chairman of a foundation that works on the environment back in my home country of New Zealand. So a bunch of things now, keeping myself busy.
I was going to say, you're definitely not just Netflix and a beer on a Tuesday night. I mean, you got yourself busy, which is great. It's nice to hear that you're working hard on a lot of things. I do want to ask, what was that jump from private sector to politics? I mean, that's not unheard of ever. I mean, that's happened before with many people, but yeah, I guess for you, was it just something you kind of fell into, or you wanted to make that pivot, or someone asked you to do it? How did that kind of work?
It was a mixture of intent and serendipity. So I've always wanted to do public service at some stage of my life. And coming here to the United States, I became a citizen around 14 years ago. And so the opportunity to serve my new country was too hard to beat. So a combination of wanting to do something and then the opportunity and the serendipity aspect of it was I'd been working on the General Motors IPO, initial public offering, which you recall General Motors went through a bankruptcy proceeding. The government bailed it out. And then I came in as part of the team to help bring the company back to the public markets and repay the government the investment that they'd made. So I started to get involved with DC a little bit just through my work with the government on that and got fascinated by the whole DC situation. And then the 2012 election cycle rolled around about the time that I finished my work with GM. So I knew someone who knew someone at the Romney campaign. They introduced me. I went in, and the sort of rest is history. So just a fortunate moment in time to do something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah, that's great. Well, someone that knows someone that knows someone is very DC. So that sounds about right. I think the work you did on the Romney campaign was really the transition campaign and what happened was very interesting. So I definitely want to save some time for that. So let's kind of set the table here. So, you know, obviously, peaceful transfer of power, presidential transitions become more in focus, have become more in focus over the past, you know, couple of years. And I guess I just want to ask why for you, you know, you've kind of staked this kind of space for yourself of working on presidential transitions. Why do you find it so important and so important as to say year zero, which you can describe what that is, of we have to reconceptualize this transition period as a kind of, half year or full year, year zero for a 5 year kind of thing. How is that so important? Why are these presidential transitions important? And why do you think they should be more important, I guess?
Yeah, great question. So just take a step back. January 20th, 2021, I mentioned that. And I left the White House at 11:59, just before the inauguration of Joe Biden as the new president. I was walking around the White House that morning. The president, Trump, had left at 8:30. And so there was just this shadow staff left in the White House, including me. And you have to visualize what the White House looks like on a transition day. It's an empty shell. Mm-hmm. Basically, all the offices are... have been cleared out. There's no computers, there's no paperwork, there's no people. It's more like an office building, an unleased office building on the weekend. And here is the most important institution in the world. And there is 100% turnover in the people in it. And no other institution that I've ever worked in, or to be honest, that anyone can think of, has this amazing flick of a switch transfer from one team to another. And this is the most important institution in the world. It essentially has the most influence of any that you can think of. So it just brought home to me that there's this amazing transfer of power. And we think about the inauguration and everything, but behind the scenes, how you do that is just absolutely critical as you go from literally one team to another in this vacant thing called the White House. So that's the sort of context, and I've always been fascinated by it, but it just brought home to me then. Now then, take a step back from that, we have this deficit of trust in institutions in the country. 75% of the country think we're going on the wrong track. When you look at the surveys, there is no institution in the country, no major institution in the country, where people have more than 50% confidence that it's going to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. So we had this just amazing deficit in trust, which leads to the sense that the country's going in the wrong way. And my attitude has always been, you can either observe things and complain about it, or you can try and do something about it. So my work, both in the White House and since then, is how do you make the White House more effective? So the book is about transitions, but it's actually more about how you make the White House more effective. And in order to make it more effective, there's this period before you govern that's incredibly important. So if you wait until January 20th of incoming administration, the whole big wave of governance crashes over you and it's too late. So you have to do all the preparatory work to get ready for governing. You've obviously got to win the election. Otherwise, you end up with an ineffective and dysfunctional White House. So firstly, the book's about how do you configure a White House to make it much more effective? And then secondly, more importantly, what do you do in preparation to achieve that? And hence this concept of year zero, which is just a way of saying there's a year before you take over governance, and there's so much work to do in terms of choosing people, deciding policies and everything. How do you do that in a way that gives you the best chance of having an incredibly important and effective institution?
Yeah, that all tracks. And I think people listening are probably going to say, well, you know, I mean, that's great, Chris. You know, you get in there, you fill the White House, you know, you fill some positions. I mean, what's the big deal? You're talking about a year? Like, I mean, we get it, but like, you know, it shouldn't take that much time. I mean, what are we really talking about here? So you detail in the book how filling the government is a massive, massive enterprise. I mean, it's actually amazing that we do it, I guess, sort of, or have been doing it. So just tell us a little bit about, like, from your vantage point, like how government is kind of organized and filled and why it takes so long and why it's important. In the book, you talk about many things. You talk about the executive office of the president. And under that, there's a bunch of things. You have the VP, NSC, Homeland Security, OMB, National Economic Council, domestic policy, personnel, communications. Like, there's so many offices. They're all in that Eisenhower building right next door or whatever, right? I mean, the Eisenhower executive building.
Office building. Yeah.
And it's so, like, when you're reading through the book, you're like, oh my goodness, like, there really is so much. And some people would say, like, we don't need all those things. So I guess, why does it take so long? Why are all those pieces essential? Why do we need them? And why it makes sense that you would need a full year to really kind of plan out how to do that.
Got it. So a few points. So the first point is, most institutions, like the private sector ones that I work for, you change one person at a time or maybe a team at a time. But the entities in the institution continues on and really there's a culture that those people are absorbed into. In the White House, it's 100% turnover. So you have to just think that how critical it is to start to build teams and culture before you go in. Otherwise, you have people who are ruling the world, leading the world, who are introducing themselves on the first day. So that, you know, that just can't make sense. Obviously, you need to have a fully functioning team that is working on the most important issues in the world. So that's sort of point number one. The second is, the president appoints around 8,000 people, 4,000 of those are full-time. Of those 4,000, around 1,000 are confirmed by the Senate. So there's a massive number of people that he or she has to have in terms of have a functioning White House and a functioning set of agencies. So 4,000 people, think of it. Again, if you start to appoint those on day one, it's going to take you years before you get all 4,000 appointed, but you've only got 4 years, and in particular, year one is incredibly important. So there's just this massive number of people that the president needs to have as many as possible in place working together on day one. So just the volume of people that he appoints. Then think of those 4,000 people are generally speaking, the most senior roles, both in the White House and the various agencies. They're commanding a federal government that has around 2 million people in it, plus a few million other contractors. Mm-hmm. So you have this small nucleus of people running one of the biggest organizations in the world. So thinking about how you organize those people in an effective fashion so that they can actually take advantage of the 2 million people that they are responsible for, also incredibly important. So it's not just appointing the people, it's making sure that they're doing the right things and are organized in a fashion. And then the sort of last aspect is, how does the president make decisions? And so thinking about how you put options in front of the president, how the president makes decisions, and then how those decisions are implemented, that just doesn't happen by magic. That requires real conscious thought. And if you're unconscious about it, you can make bad decisions. And there's been plenty of examples. And you've seen it, having read the book. I go back in history and study past presidents that come in and things they did well and things they didn't do well. And some of the mistakes they made in the early days were, I think of Bay of Pigs with Kennedy, were as a result of poor planning over the transition period. Yeah. So it's just the volume that they have to do that needs to be carried out and be ready to go on day one. You work backwards from there, and there's a year of work. Now, okay, some people can say, I could do it in 6 months, you can do it in 5 months, you can do it in 7 months. So you could argue about whether that's the full year, but there are certainly several months. And if you really want to take it in to an extreme effectiveness, a year of preparatory work just to get the people in place, the right people in place, the right policies in place, the decision-making process, the organization structures. It's just a massive exercise for, as I say, the most important institution in the world. And I guess the last comment, and then we'll go in any direction you like, is I talk a lot in the book about how. And most books you read about the White House, and I'm sure you and some of your listeners have read lots, are about what and who. Mm-hmm. So they're about what we should do, or what a White House did do, mm-hmm. or who did it, who was in the room, who made the decisions. And those are important. But you need how.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have a how, you can have all the whats and whos, but you're just going to have a disorganized chaos. And so the how aspect of it is the critical third leg of having, you know, an effective White House.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really instructive. And it's interesting as you're saying this, it's like, well, you know, if I get a, you know, you run a long campaign and I'm elected president, and then it's like, okay, here's all the things you have to do and all the things you have to fill. It's like, where's the manual for this? Like, how do we, I mean, I can't fill 4,000 people. Like, what that, how do I, you know, that has to, so I guess the question is, you talk about, you give a little bit of history, more modern history. Although presidential transitions in the early part of the country, you know, between Washington and Adams, Jefferson, were very fascinating, very different. But a lot of this in the modern era you talk about is from kind of the FDR administration. But how is there no consistency, like no consistent overarching concept of design of the executive office of the president? I mean, I understand that every president's going to come in there and they're going to do their own thing, and most presidents are wildly different from each other. Okay, cool. But the fact that we have to do this every 4 years, and you do make the point of, even if you're running for reelection, you should still do this. It might be a little bit easier. Maybe it doesn't take as long per se, but there is still that process of doing it, even if you're running for reelection. So yeah, how are we supposed to do this every 4 years if there's no consistent overarching concept over things?
Yeah, so really good point. The historical aspect is important because the size of the U.S. government, you have to recognize that how much the U.S. government has grown, in particular over the last 100 years, which is why I look at what I describe as the modern presidency from FDR onwards, and we come back to why that is. But even in the last 50 years, the size and scope of the government in terms of the amount of dollars they spend, the amount of people they employ, the amount of policies that they influence has just grown exponentially. So 100 years ago, you could get away with getting elected and then starting to think about the transition. The other point is that historically, up until FDR, it was a four-month transition mm-hmm. rather than a 75-day. Mm-hmm. So the 20th Amendment brought the inauguration day forward and shortened the transition period. So more to do in less time, all of a sudden we found. Then to your question of why isn't there an overarching structure, it's sort of like a house that gets built and you add a room on at a time and you don't have an architect and you end up with an extra kitchen here, an extra bedroom here, and extend the garage. And the history, to some extent, it sounds a bit facetious for an institution that's put in the White House, but it's been a little like that. They set up, in FDR's point of view, the executive office of the president. Until that time, he just had the cabinet reporting to him and a couple of personal aides. It was the first time there was anyone there as to help him make decisions. And there was just two or three offices to it. Then there was a fourth office, then a fifth. And then we had the National Economic Council, then the Domestic Policy Council, then the Communications Office, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a little like government itself. It just got added on to in pieces one at a time. All of those rooms that they added made sense at the time, but no one will seldom ever step back and say, well, hang on, what's the architecture of the house that we're trying to build? Mm. The other point is that every 4 years or 8 years at the most, you get a new person come in. And so it's not like you have a continuous flow of people thinking about this. You have a new person come in. They've just come off winning the campaign. They want to get on with governance. Probably the last thing that I want to think about is how I designed the White House. And increasingly, we're selecting presidents because of their campaigning and media and other skills, not their ability to actually sort of run the organization that they take over. So it's a whole series of factors. I guess the last one I'll say, in the private sector, you have sort of competition. So you have organizational structures evolve because the best wins. The White House has a monopoly on itself. It is one. So there's no sort of pressure to make it more effective other than internal pressure. And as I say, generally the people who are selected by the public and then the people that they choose are much more interested in policy than they are in running things effectively.
Just a small, I guess, footnote on this, just to mention it, is I can hear some of my conservative or even libertarian friends saying, well, yeah, Chris, it's too fucking big. That's why we should get rid of most of governmental entities. We don't need a Department of Education and a Federal Reserve and commerce and energy. We just get rid of it, and we just get rid of it, and then your problem solved. So that's government's too big. We shouldn't take all this time and energy and manpower and money trying to fill something that's not even going to get filled. Why is it getting bigger anyways? We need to go the opposite way. What do you usually say to folks that kind of, have that kind of spirit of thinking about government and filling it?
Well, the first thing I say, that's a sort of a what question. What's the right size of government? Uh-huh. And I try not to address that. I try and make the book bipartisan, so it's both sides. The second thing, although clearly my sort of ideology, given my politics, is to smaller government, so I'm sympathetic to the argument. But people have been talking about the 50 years and what's happened. The government's got bigger.
So right.
Until we make a dramatic decrease in the size of government, which I don't see happening anytime soon, and let's say we did. Let's say we took the 2 million people down to 1.5 million. Not going to happen, but let's say we did. That's still 1.5 million people that need to be organized right. by a group of 4,000 political appointees. Goodness. So the problem might get a little smaller.
Yeah.
Firstly, I don't think it's going to happen, but even if it did, those 4,000 people still have to think about how they run a government which spends over $6 trillion, employs several millions of people, and has policies which influence every aspect of not only our lives domestically, but internationally as well. So I'm sympathetic to the smaller government, but even if that happened, the issue's not going to go away.
Well, kind of going back real quick to the whole thing with FDR, it seems like a lot of these, as the world kept evolving and expanding, especially after the Depression and World War II, you started seeing that we started expanding in terms of, an industrial age, and then we expand into a technological age. You start to see on the global stage and domestic stage, oh, there's a need for something. So we should create a space to deal with that. It's not, I mean, maybe there are some things for in government, I'm sure there are, that are, you know, okay, that's probably not needed, or, you know, that could be done a different way. But I mean, I think Department of Education was created for a particular need. And I think, or you could take another example more recently, the one I remember was after 9/11, we developed the Department of Homeland Security. And it was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense to do that. So people could disagree, I guess, on these things, but I would suspect in my casual reading of history that a lot of these departments, or these you know, kind of sub-departments, if you will, are arising or forming out of a need that we're seeing. You can see that, you know, maybe with the EPA that Nixon did, that he established, or organizations, other departments, out of a need. And it's like, okay, well, we have this need. We need to create a kind of, you know, department or sub-department of it. It just, like, again, with Homeland Security after 9/11, it's like, okay, we need to have this, a whole department. It can't just be in the FBI or CIA or the NSA. It has to be its own kind of thing, and they work together. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, is that the kind of charitable view of why we have so many, you know, kind of departments and all these things to fill in government, or is it more of just people are making this so they can just, you know, house and fill more jobs, or that's what it seems.
No. I don't take the cynical view. Every agency or sub agency, generally speaking, has been created to solve a need, solve a problem. So they've been created with the best of intentions.
Yeah.
Pretty much exclusively. But what happens over time is that need changes, mm-hmm. but the entity normally carries mm-hmm. on. And what also happens is, because there's no, what I describe as, overarching architect thinking about it, what happens is an entity or a part might get added, but people aren't always thinking, well, hang on, there's five other mm-hmm. departments working on that same mm-hmm. issue. Now we just added a sixth. So now we need to coordinate the six together. Right. So often there's a little bit of a myopia of this is a need, this is an itch, let's scratch it, without the sort of the broader thinking of, well, what's the implications of that in terms of the complications that it creates? And by the way, in 10 years' time, when the need has evolved into something else, and by the way, someone's added yet another department somewhere else, how to deal with that. So again, think of it more, we built a room or we built an agency because we've got an extra kid, so we need another room. Right. But someone's got to be thinking, taking a step back and saying, what's the overall architecture? Right. And then again, I come back to it. The White House, or the Executive Office of the President, is this tiny little nucleus that commands or has jurisdiction over these several millions of people. So you might add a new agency or create a sub-agency, which is several tens of thousands of people over time, and that needs to somehow get direction from something. So even the nucleus becomes even more important as the size of all of the agencies around it grows.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I do hear that argument for sure. Okay, so we've kind of talked about a lot of the particulars, government, all these things, the needs. So tell us about year zero. So when you were talking about it, what needs to be a year, and there's all these things, and here's all the places we need to fill. So what's going on during that year? How busy would everybody be doing? So tell us about the design, the plan, the execution phase, with these seven tasks. You give a leadership team, strategy, core process, structure, plan, policy, pipeline, people pipeline. So maybe just kind of lay it out for us. What is the year zero?
Yeah, start with the fact that when most people think of year zero, they're thinking about the campaign. And by the way, year zero for 2025 election is 2024 election, 2025 inauguration has already started. So we're a week into it as we talk now. So most people think about the campaign. And indeed, there is this huge amount of work going into getting elected. That's not what I address. What I address is all of the planning around the governance if you win. So there's these two paths, parallel paths that go, and the public sees the campaigning aspect of it because the candidates are out there, they're spending money, they're advertising everything. behind the scenes, you start with a very small team and then you build up to a large team. So why don't we just take a couple of recent historical examples. So in the Romney case, we started with two people around April, myself and Governor Mike Leavitt, who is an associate of Mitt Romney's and close confidant. And by election day, we had just over 500 people in the team organized with several hundred others ready to go the day after the election had we won.
So this is April of 2020 that you did this? April of 2012.
The Biden team, to take them as a second example, and obviously I was involved on the other side. But it's relatively well documented. Again, they started with a small team around now in that electoral cycle, and that was led by a senator, Ted Kaufman, who is again close confidant of President Biden's. And the executive director, the position that I held in the Romney case, was held by Jeff Zients, who's the current chief of staff in the White House. They started, as I understand it, about the same time, March, April of the year, the election year, in that case, 2020. And by the election time, they had close to 1,000 people ready to go.
Wow.
So this is not a small little group. Sitting in a back room doing some planning. This is a huge entity in its own right. So what are those 1,000 people doing? Firstly, it starts small and then grows exponentially as you get closer towards the election. So there's a whole group of people who are putting together short lists of candidates for all the major positions. So when you think about the 4,000 appointees that I mentioned, someone's got to put together a list of 5, 6, 10 names for every one of those appointments. So there's tens of thousands of people that are potentially being processed in some way, vetted, their strengths and weaknesses, and then starting to, after the election, have interviews with them to try and determine who's right and who's not. So you need a huge team just to start to put together those lists and organize them. That's one side. Yeah. And there's all the implementation of the policy, legislation, and executive orders. Generally, when a president comes in, and it's true of President Biden, was true of President Trump, they issue a whole lot of executive orders in the early weeks. Executive orders are, as the name suggests, orders to the agencies to do certain things. So someone's going to be drafting those and analyzing them and vetting them and getting legal clearance for them. So that's a whole another massive exercise. Mm-hmm. Then there's getting ready for the president's transition period, the 75 days roughly from election through to inauguration. You don't start thinking about that on the day that he or she's elected. Right. You need to have every one of those days documented and thought through, and what's he going to do and how's he going to spend his time. So there's a team working away on that. So it sounds incredibly simple, but it's like a startup on steroids.
Yeah.
Anyone who's worked in a small company that goes from, I probably can't think of any in my private sector, that goes from two people to 600, 700, 800 in 6 months, just you're adding tens of dozens of people a week, giving them jobs, getting them organized. So there's just this huge bow wave of activity that starts small, builds around the convention, it really starts to take off. The other thing to think about is lots of media interest, and in particular, as it gets close to the election, who's going to be the Secretary of State? Who's going to be the Secretary of Treasury? Mm-hmm. It goes from this sort of sleepy back office concept to this really interesting part, and then starting to merge with the campaign and make sure all the campaign people potentially have jobs. Just this great volume of work. And again, it sounds a little kind of procedural, but it's unbelievably important for the success of the organization. And making good people decisions and making good policy decisions, again, can determine the success or otherwise of an administration. So what I do in the book is just lay out how that all could and should work. And It's all of the things I mentioned, but it's also, how's the president going to make the decisions? How are we going to structure the White House? Do we need to rethink the architecture of the White House? Maybe some of these offices that we've had in the past shouldn't be organized the way they are. Maybe this is a good time to have a little bit of a renovation. And so, again, having teams of people working away on that and coordinating them in effective fashion is, I think, a super interesting and important part. So what I try to do in the book is make that as interesting as possible so that people don't just go, oh, okay, that's what you do on day 2, 3, 4, 5. It's how does this all fit together and how does it relate to what then people see? Because they see the campaign, they see a president elected, and then they see the White House starting to do things. So hopefully it gives them some sense, takes them behind the scenes a little bit about how all that happens and how the bits fit together.
A few questions here. So back to the one I asked earlier, wouldn't it be, or let me ask, how do you think this would work? So obviously you have different presidents and they're going to do different, yep, you know, things, and they're going to want their people and all these things. But how much of that can be, I don't want to say templated. That's not what I'm looking for, but like, you know what I mean? Like there's a kind of that overarching concept of like, okay, yep, these all things are positions that need to be filled. Here's procedurally how you could go about doing this, regardless of who's there. It could be who you could be, whatever personality, you could be whatever temperament, but here's a kind of sort of manual template of how to do it. If you want to do it different, I mean, that's your choice, but here's a very organized, you know, kind of administrative way of doing this. How much of that kind of skeleton could be there? And then how much of it would kind of divert from that sort of, you know, whatever they want?
Yeah, no, it's a really good way of thinking about it. And the answer is you can standardize some things and customize others. Okay. That's the way that I talk mm-hmm. about it. And so what are the aspects that you should customize? The closer you get to the president, the more you need to customize, because different presidents make decisions in different True. Ways. And you need to have a White House that's responsive to the president. Mm-hmm. So I go through in the book, talking about historical presidents and how they made decisions. Mm-hmm. And not only are personalities of presidents different, but the way in which they make decisions is different as mm-hmm. well. So to take a couple of examples, President Obama was very intellectual in the way that he made decisions. He loved briefing books. He really loved to work through every angle and every aspect. He wanted to be prepared. He wanted to be, you know, the smartest person in the room about a particular topic. That was the way he made decisions. President Trump, another extreme, much more intuitive in his thinking. What he loved to have is people around him in the Oval Office debating issues. He didn't want to have pre-cooked notions. He didn't want to have big briefing books. He wanted to have, and I talked through some examples of the trade group, for example, which had five different personalities arguing about trade policy. And he loved the toing and froing of smart people in front of him debating ideas. That's how he made decisions, at a very intuitive level, listening to people who are experts in the area debate the topic. Totally different decision-making style. So you need to customize, or in this case, the Trump one, because I was in charge of it, customize the way in which meetings with the president were held and the way in which all the work that was done before then resulted in a really effective meeting. Mm. So that's the customization aspect, helping the president make great decisions and making sure that you don't try and change the president, you change the process around it. Then the further away from you get from the president, the more you can standardize. So, and there are aspects of things like the National Security Council and all the work that they do on security aspects that are incredibly important and should carry over from institution to institution. But even when you're standardizing, you can't just assume that it's going to happen, because you've got a whole new set of people. Yeah. So those people need to be helped to understand what it is that used to happen and why it happened that way and how they can fit into it. So even with a, you know, Vercom, a standardized approach, you need to design it in a way that picks up the best of history, applies it, and then you need to teach all those people what that looks like. So I go into the book and the bits that you can standardize and the bits you can customize, but the important concept to think is the closer you get to the president, the more you need to change the structure and the way the White House works to suit the president's style.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned the book, and it's been mentioned elsewhere, you know, as an example, is, you know, President Carter was a micromanager perfectionist. Yep. I mean, he wanted to literally be in every single thing, and you just can't. You can't govern that way. But then there's other people that are more laissez-faire, and it's just like, you do it. I think Obama had elements of that where, you know, he let, you know, Clinton and Kerry just like, all right, you guys just go run Secretary of the State Department and you just come tell me about it. Like, you know, which is a way to do that, I guess. But
yeah, and there's no right or wrong in all this. This is style.
Yeah.
And different presidents have different styles, and you just need to have an effective White House to match the style. So I talk about decision making. The other angle, which you just mentioned, which is also another dimension of a president, is that how much he or she wants to delegate versus be in control. Slightly different to how they make decisions. So again, the two extremes would be Carter, President Carter, who wanted to make every decision in the White House. He didn't want to delegate. He wanted to be in control of them all. He had a prodigious energy and work ethic. That guy worked, you know, 15, 20 hours a day, and he was involved in everything. Now, you can debate whether it was a good idea or not, but that was his, the way he, President Reagan, exactly the opposite. President Reagan had some basic principles about how he, what he wanted to do. He had four or five things that he thought were the most important. He wanted to be involved in decisions to do with that, but he delegated everything else. So again, totally different styles, and the White House around that president needs to accommodate that different style of delegation and decision-making or aspect that you're looking at.
Yeah, I think that that's it's interesting how we see the styles, but then not only do we see styles, but we see how does that have impact on policy and, you know, things that happen in, you know, kind of world affairs. I guess one other follow-up to that is, this still seems very like, even if you have like the kind of flexibility around the customization around the president, you know, we have a country that's at least 330 million people. Like, there's so many, like, it's just so crazy to think that a small group, like, if you take a country like, I don't know, even a country like Germany, which is 60 million people, I think that's right, or a country like Norway, which is 5 or 7 million or whatever it is, that seems kind of feasible, right? Because it's like, okay, you have, you know, all of these positions, you have government, okay, but it's like manageable. That makes sense. But like, in a democratic republic such as ours, trying to do all of those things that way for 330 million plus, it starts to feel, in my mind, objectively, like it's getting really spread thin, like very stretched. Like, what kind of other bigger enterprise? Like, I think this is why your idea is a good one, because it's like, you got to, there's like, it's just starting to become like, it's starting to really grow. And it's like, well, if this continues to grow, like, is it really going to be possible that, you know, a small nucleus of people do this? Like, that's why you would need to be extremely administrative, extremely kind of surgical in how you're doing these things. Do you ever worry about that? Like, maybe it's too big. Like, maybe how do we rein that in to try and say, what's efficient here? What are our limits here? Or do we, like you're saying, do we restructure a few things to say, like, how do we have like big teams kind of doing things? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, so it's even bigger than what you say. So if you think there's the White House, which is, as I say, a few hundred people, a few thousand that the president appoints, but in the White House, a few hundred that manage a government that's got a couple of million employees. If you add the military, we're up to 4 million. You add contractors, it's up to 10 million. Yep. That influences a country with 330 million people in, but actually influences the world with 8 billion in. So you start with a few hundred and you're actually influencing up several billions.
Yeah.
when you think about the policies and what we're involved in around the world. So it's a even bigger task than you think of. So again, I don't make a judgment of whether I'm a Republican or a Democrat and what the right size of government is. I just take the reality of the situation that we have at the moment. What I do say, though, to your point is part of the reason why we have this distrust in institutions, back to my fundamental first point, is because they don't do a good enough job. So you see the mess that they make of a whole lot of things, from the trivial through to the really important, from you think of all the things that government's messed up over the last few years. And again, I try and stay away from politics, both sides of the aisle. And then you think of basic citizen services. You know, what's, think of the smile you have when you deal with a private sector entity that delivers a service to you, and then the frown that you have when you have to deal with the government. And most people go, the government's a mess. It can't do my health properly. It can't do my social security properly. It can't, you know, go to the XYZ, whatever. Whatever small example you have with the government. So from basics, everyday citizen services, through to the big overarching global issues, majority of people don't think the government's working. And so that might be an issue about how big it is, but it's just not effective. It's not solving people's problems. And hence we have a distrust in the institution of government. And hence we have this deep sense that the country's going in the wrong direction. And there's lots of other issues involved in it, but one of the significant aspects is the government just isn't solving my problems for me. And what I say is I can't solve the, you know, the 2 million people. That's, someone else can debate that. My focus is what I describe as the head and the heart of the government, which is the White House. Because if you don't get that right, everything else is irrelevant. If you mess up the White House and it makes bad decisions and it implements things badly and it puts in bad policy or it doesn't organize agencies to do the right thing, nothing works. So I'm in this, and I'm also, what can I can control? And so all the recommendations that I make in the book, and as you know, there's 50 of them sort of grouped into the various themes that I talk about, they're practical, they're aspirational. They make a difference, and to a large extent, they're inside the control of the president or president-elect. And so we can complain and we can say the government's got to be better, and I agree with that. You've got to start somewhere. You've got to actually have a plan to make things better. You're not going to suddenly change the 2 million people and make them, you know, 50% better. So that's why I focus on what can we manage. We can manage the White House. It's small enough. What's the most important entity in the government? It's the White House, because it's the center of everything. And what are a series of steps that an incoming president can make to make his or her White House that much better? So it's taking the massive big problem that we have, which is distrust in government, and try to break it down into something that we can actually do something about.
That's super important, I think. So I'm gonna merge a few questions here together. So you talk about this leadership structure as having the candidate, the governance team, 4 to 5 people, campaign leadership team, 6 to 8 people, and your zero leadership team, 6 to 9 people, and doing that as early as possible. So maybe as examples, I'd be curious here. So maybe talk about your experience with the Romney campaign. So this was sort of a kind of, I guess, a sort of first of sorts. So, you know, for listeners, you know, obviously it was Obama running for re-election in 2012 and Romney running for president on the Republican side. And so you were doing this. You were doing this, as you said, I think you said in April. So you're doing it a good 6-7 months before the election day. And as we know, the results, like, it didn't work out for Romney. So you just spent 6 months, 7 months or more of your life doing something that didn't happen. Right. So that has to be a strange kind of feeling, but that it was super important to do that because, you know, if Romney did win, and it was not, it wasn't a blowout, I don't think, by Obama. It was a lot closer than in 08 for sure. If I remember correctly, I think North Carolina went for Romney as opposed to in 08, it went for Obama. So there it was some states lost and it was closer. But the point is that you didn't get to do all those things, right? So what are the things that you learned, I guess, on that first sort of kind of time doing on a big campaign? Where did you pull stuff from of how to, like, you know, where these ideas came from, whether it was from the private sector work you did or elsewhere? And then what was the contrast like doing that with the Trump campaign of that transition, not the campaign, but the presidency of, you know, the transition, I guess, transition from Trump to Biden and saying, okay, well, this is a little bit different. I don't know if you worked on, you didn't work on the one between, in 2017, 16 or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. So yeah, maybe give us that comparison between Romney for one that did end up happening or did not happen, excuse me. And then one that that did. What was that kind of juxtaposition like?
Yeah, so I've been involved in three transition cycles in a row now. So the 2012, where we worked on a really highly organized transition process, but lost the election. Yep. So didn't get a chance to put it in place. The Trump incoming administration, where I came in after the election and helped them transition. And that's been well documented. They did a lot of work before the election, but then they rebooted it after the election and started again. So that was a transition of a totally different character. I'll come back to that. And then the third one is I ran the White House efforts transitioning out to the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's also been well documented with the contested election and everything. Mm-hmm. So I've been involved in three really quite different cycles. They're about as graphically different as you can think of, both from the inside and the outside.
Sure,
and highly structured and not so structured. So, yeah, lots of lessons to learn along the way. And that's, again, informed some of what I've written about, clearly. Mm-hmm. I think if I start with the Romney one first, one of the things, it's brutal. You have to do all of the work that you assume that you need to, assuming that you're going to win, because if you win, you need to be ready. Yeah. So you need to do everything that you would do otherwise to win, and then you lose. So I certainly remember we had a conference call organized for 7:30 in the morning the day after the election in 2012 with all 500 or 600 people on it to give them their instructions to go. Okay, we're prepared. Now it's go. And we literally got on the conference call at 7:30 and said, well, I'm sorry, we lost. Thank you all for your efforts. Ugh. And you have 2 days to pack up your gear and go home or go back to your life. Ugh. So you grow from two people to 500 or 600 and then back to zero within a couple of days. So it's brutal.
That's weird.
It's brutal. But it's what you have to do. And in the Romney case, probably because of the candidate, you know, Mitt Romney came from the private sector as well. Mike Leavitt had been in the government quite a while. I'd come from the private sector. It was just a very well organized team. And so had we had the chance to put it in place, I think we would have been really excellent. And I think people point back to that, all the work that we did, which we documented in another book, as really extremely professional, well done, and a good guidepost. And I'd like to think subsequent administrations probably copy aspects of it. So I would say that was incredibly well done. And just as Mike Leavitt said, it was the ship that never sailed. We built a great ship.
It's good.
We didn't get a chance. So that's that. On the Trump case, as I mentioned, Chris Christie and Rich Berger were the team that were leading that. And they followed to some extent the same template. But then the Trump administration sort of rebooted the whole campaign, and that's all been sort of documented in various books. And I came in after the election based on they knew that the work I'd done. And so to help them with this sort of very short accelerated period. And I came in for a couple of days and ended up staying 4 years. So that's a whole story in its own right. But clearly, given the abbreviated work period, some of the sort of missteps in terms of personnel and things like that that you saw in the early months of the Trump administration, I think were driven by this just lack of preparation then on the way out, running the White House, thinking about two aspects. One was a second term, second Trump term, and I was working on that planning at the same time as I was working on the planning to an outside party coming in if we lost, which is what happened. And then that whole transition was affected by the contested election, this technical step called ascertainment, which was delayed, which meant that the Biden team had a delayed access to information, which is very contested and everything. So that was just a very difficult transition. Again, we can talk more about that if you like, but that was, I guess, from my perspective, I learned an enormous amount trying to manage it on the way out. That was, and I did it with the knowledge of having been in the White House for 4 years, whereas the previous two, I was planning without really having had the experience of having to deal with the issues that I was planning for. So all of that I've tried to capture in this book called Year Zero. Right. So I've taken the benefit of three presidential cycles of quite different nature and 4 years of working in the White House and tried to make it not only a sort of a theoretical concept, but a really practical and hopefully readable set of suggestions.
Yeah, yeah. Let me follow up on that, I guess, is this, I'm curious about many of the things we talked about, but just more specifically, you don't have to, you know, divulge anything particular if you don't want to, but when you were talking about kind of the, okay, here's the kind of customization piece with the president, you know, Mitt Romney, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden are, and granted, you didn't work with Joe Biden, I don't think directly, but, you know, the team, I guess, but those are all three different dudes. They're yeah. very different. And obviously you worked in the Trump White House, so, you know, probably a little bit more, time and content that you have. But when you see, like, when you see, like, working in different phases of that, right? As you said, three different kind of transitions. Is there ever any point where you're like, you know what? I thought this would work. That does not work. Like, this should not be the case. Or on the kind of personal side of, like, you know what? This would work if this person just did it that way, but they're the president. They don't want to do it that way. What do you do then? What's the kind of plan B? What's the kind of thing like that? So I guess what are, maybe if you have examples or whatever at any point, where is it that particular aspect of, here's what works, but here's where you have to have some, like, flexibility, or things have to be a little bit more fungible depending on that core team of whomever that is. Where do you kind of see the maneuverability of that?
What a number of chiefs of staff are often the people who are really dealing with the issue that you're raising. So the mistake they make is that we're going to change the president. And we're going to have the system because the system works. And they have this grand view of the way a system should work, and then they apply it, and it doesn't suit the president. So you have a square peg in a round hole.
Yeah.
And the lesson that they learn, and sometimes they learn it quickly and sometimes they learn it slowly, is it's not the president who's going to change, it's the system is going to change. Mm. And so the best chiefs of staff are the ones who realize that quickly and don't try and have this template approach. Mm. Again, there's some things you can template that the president doesn't see, but the things that the president deals with on a day-to-day basis have to be customized to that person. So it's, again, the whole concept of Year Zero is to try and determine that before you get into the White House, not afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're exactly right. The processes that we put in place for Mitt Romney wouldn't have worked for Donald mm-hmm. Trump. Just different people, yeah. different yeah. decision-making process, different delegatory stills, mm-hmm. different mood. And you have to accommodate the president. The single most important person is the person who the country has elected. The rest of you are there. None of you have been elected. Mm-hmm. None of you have any responsibility. All of your responsibility comes from the president. So all of your activities and all of your life have to be centered around that person and helping them make the best decisions. Mm-hmm. You also have to recognize presidents aren't these sort of homogenous, unfeeling, unthinking people. They're humans like the rest of us. Yeah. So what might work on Tuesday may not work on Wednesday. Right. What might work at 6 o'clock in the evening may not work at 6 o'clock in the morning. So even with individual presidents, you have to be incredibly flexible. Mm. You know, has the president just come from a 3-day trip to Asia? Right. He's short on sleep. Yeah. He's not making the best decisions. Maybe this isn't the time to bring in the meaning of life decision. Maybe you shuffle it around. Maybe that goes from Wednesday this week to Thursday next week. So it's not just the way that you interact with the presidents, the way that you manage the system around them to accommodate their style, their personality, their mood, their schedule that they're on, all of those things. And that sounds like common sense, right? But common sense is often in short supply. And so in my book, if people, and I hope some of your listeners will obviously have the chance to read it. Some of you, they might just go, of course you do that. Of course you do that. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean it happens that way. And so simple things done really well can often be incredibly important. But I come back to it. The central objective of all of this is to customize the White House in a way that works for the president.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. No, I think that makes sense. And you give it, there's this really nice kind of wheel in the book, in this kind of diagram or chart, where you talk about this needing a creation of the office of President of the United States. So you have like the president kind of in the center, and then the office of the President of the United States. And then you have outside of it, many of the agencies, and then, or like, you know, you have like OM.
Or the offices.
Yeah, the offices, yeah.
Yeah, you have the offices of the White House. Yeah, so maybe I'll explain.
Yeah, it's great because the visual's great, so obviously I can't show it, but it's really nice because it kind of looks at, I mean, it's a good organized thing of like, okay, here's a kind of hierarchy of sorts of how things are, whether you want to do top down or, you know, middle out or whatever, but it kind of works. So yeah, just kind of explain that piece and why it's important generally, but also for like policy as well.
Yeah. So maybe I can do a little historical tour and explain something. We're an hour into it, but probably some people are going, what the hell do you mean by the executive office of the president? What's an agency? So take a step back to what are the fundamental building blocks of the federal government. So I mentioned 2 million people. The great bulk of those people work inside agencies. So think of the Department of Treasury, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Health and Human Services, the agencies who provide services to the country or run national security or whatever. So that's the great bulk of the people, and they're what I describe as agencies. Then you have this thing called the Executive Office of the President, which, as the name suggests, is a smaller sort of nucleus of the federal government. That was created in 1939 by FDR. Until that time, as I mentioned earlier, he just had a couple of personal aides and the agencies. So the heads of agencies, heads of the most important agencies, form what's called the cabinet, which people, most people have heard of. But they're agency heads. They're the Treasury Secretary and people like that. Until FDR, that was the main decision-making body for the president. Mm. When he wanted to make a decision, he called his cabinet together and got advice from them. With the creation of Executive Office of the President, you started to push the cabinet away as a decision-making body, and the president started to surround himself with political appointees who formed White House and Executive Office of the President. Think of those sort of interchangeable terms. Started with a few, now several hundred or a couple of thousand, depending on how you define it. So they've become the principal people who advise the president on how to make decisions and then interface with the agencies to make sure that they happen. Mm. Cabinet's still important, but way less important than it used to be. Mm. So when I talk about the White House, I'm talking about those people who do it. Now, those people need to be organized. So these people called assistants to the president. I was one of them. There's about 25 of those in most White Houses, and then there's around 20 in the cabinet. So there's sort of 45 people who think they report to the president. So you need some organizing principle about how the president deals with 45 people. So this position called chief of staff came about. Most people have heard of chiefs of staff, you know, because they're prominent people. They're in some ways the second, next to the vice president, the second most important person in the executive branch of the government. Chiefs of staff didn't exist 100 years ago, so that's a modern creation. Eisenhower was the first one to have one, and they were there was an office set up called the Office of the Chief of Staff, and they tried to organize all of these people who were appearing to advise the president. What I'm talking about now is a whole other evolution of this concept of the Chief of Staff, to have an Office of the President in the United States. It was just a way of the president organizing all of these people and entities and agencies and independent agencies around him or her. And it's sorry, I'm going to go into much more detail in the book, but the basic theory is the chief of staff's role has now become so big that it's become unwieldy. Mm-hmm. This poor chief of staff, they only last about 80 months, 2 years now. And I make the point in the book, how come the president expects to last 4 or 8 years and chiefs of staff only last 2 years?
If that.
So there's something wrong with the chief of staff role. Mm-hmm. So the president needs to have a team around him, and that team needs to be the people who are really looking after his interests, that are really making sure things happen. And so I created this concept of the Office of the President of the United States, and they are the way in which he gets information from the outside world, he or she, the way that he gets things done. And so it's a it's an evolution of a concept of the way to do it, and hopefully. Mm-hmm. As you say, if you picked up the visual,
yeah, it's great.
Hard to describe it in words, but there's a nice visual in there that shows how all of this could work.
Yeah, it's interesting because we were talking earlier, and again, people are kind of seeing it kind of in vivo here, that there's something that works until it doesn't. And then you need to create a new thing, a new office. Yeah. Right? This is kind of how it works, right? Things kind of get bigger and you have to say, okay. I should note, my friend Lindsay Chorinsky, she's a historian. She's great. She wrote a book on the cabinet. And basically, I had no idea about this, but Washington created the cabinet. Like, it's not like any of our founding documents or things like that. So right from the beginning, we've been doing this of there's a need. We have to make some kind of creation, right? And I think it was, you know, the story of that's very interesting. People should pick up her book and read about it. But it's interesting how we've always kind of done that. You've mentioned FDR a bunch of times. Like, there's, again, all of these things we have to, well, we're going to have a new kind of thing here to organize this. And so, yeah, even still, if things are dysfunctional or they're not working efficiently, I mean, Eisenhower was the master of doing all this stuff administratively. Well, you have to restructure it or reorganize it. And sometimes you might subsume other things or put it underneath or together or take some things out or build new things. I mean, that's how you have to fix things with what you're handed.
And a couple of thoughts. Yeah. One is history is fascinating. Mm-hmm, I find history fascinating anyway. So looking back on how previous presidents have done it is, I think, super interesting. And I talk a little bit about that and give examples. But the other thing is it's not just the sort of structure, it's how you deal with personalities and bad actors and people who leak and people who work around the system. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to it. How do you deal with human nature? Mm-hmm. Because the White House is full of these people who theoretically are there just for the president, but have their own agendas and their own personalities. And often they don't know the president. They've been appointed because they look like they fill the slot appropriately, but they never work with the president. They come in, they've got what they want to do, and suddenly their agenda takes over. Well, how do you deal with that? And, you know, they might be a bad actor for some reason, so how do you deal with that? So it's not just the sort of how do these offices fit together, it's how does these people fit together? And I mentioned before, there's been lots of books written about the personalities in the White House. But this is about how you make those personalities work in a much more effective fashion for the president. It's not a who was in the room and who said what. It's how on earth do you make this unbelievably important, powerful organization function effectively?
I mean, yeah, people that work at like a small business can't sometimes stand each other you know, because there's different personalities. And you have thousands of people, you know, governing millions of people. There's going to be a few people just don't like, because it's just different personalities. It could fit the role and the whole thing of the whole template's laid out and great. And that makes sense. Okay, this person's qualified. Okay, all these things. And somebody in another place is just like, we don't get along. We clash, whatever. And so then it's like, okay, well, what do you do, right? Do you replace the person because the personalities are different? Or do you replace the person because, you know, even if they can do the job well, or, you know, things like that. And yeah, I mean, that's the real headache.
Yeah. Every one of us has worked in organizations that work well and organizations that don't work well. And that's a combination of how they're organized and who's in them. And the personality. So to come back to the point, that the office of the president of the United States would be the enforcers.
Yeah.
So you can't expect the president to do that. The president's got too much on his or her shoulders already. Right. They're out there trying to deal with world leaders. Right. They're going to make decisions which impact the future of the country and the world. They don't and shouldn't be expected to deal with staff issues and deal with cultural issues. Yeah. And so you need a group of people who are what I just call the enforcers. Yeah. They're the ones that are enforcing the positive culture and dealing with the bad culture as well.
Yeah. So two final questions I have here for you. One is, you mentioned, again, a few things. These are kind of different concepts. I'll fuse them together. But you talk about how there should be this element of years 1 and 3 focused on achieving results and years 2 and 4 on implementation and selling them within a 4-year term. And that's all we work with at one time. And that actually, you know, kind of right before that, you have, instead of the first 100 days, which is this kind of, you know, fun, informal thing after FDR, it should be the first kind of 200 days. So how do we get from that, the 200 days, president-elect, the whole transition team into there, and then years 1 and 3 is the kind of how do we get results, and then 2 and 4 kind of selling it and implementing them?
So we have the situation, and again, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it. We have this incredibly narrow window to get what I describe as signature legislation passed. Yep. Because we have midterms after 2 years, you have a window the first 6 months, call it 200 days, where people have just been elected, the president's coming in, he's got lots of wind at his back, he's just won an election, new Congress, everyone wants to get something done. Then by about the end of the first year, people are starting to think about the re-election and the midterms. And so your ability to really pass significant legislation starts to deteriorate materially. And then the same cycle to a lesser extent happens in year 3 and 4. So here we are, almost a year to go to the inauguration. What are the chances of signature legislation passing in the next 8 or 9 months? It's unfortunately
slim to none.
Slim to none. Okay, there you go. So the way that the government is set up, and again, I deal with the reality of life, not the way it should, but I'd like it to be, is that if you really want to get legislation passed, and I talk a lot about how important legislation is in terms of the legacy of a president, you've really only got sort of year 1 and year 3 as your principal opportunities. So you've just won an election in year 1. You don't need to keep politicking and winning it again. You've got to get results. Because that's your time to actually show the people who've just voted you in that you can get things done, in particular legislation. Then in years 2 and 4, you need to get re-elected. You need a good midterm, so you need hopefully a Congress that's on your side. So you need to be politicking and selling your results. In year 4, assuming you're going for a second term or trying to get someone from your party re-elected, you're out selling again. Mm-hmm. So you have these sort of waves, these natural waves just around the way that the government works effectively. Year 1 and 3, big opportunity for results. Year 3 and 4, sell those results, get a good electoral situation. And it's clearly not absolutely distinct. It's more of an emphasis than a 100% focus on one or the other. So that's the sort of overall flow. Then the first year, year one, the 200 days, a lot of people may have heard of FDR's 100-day sprint, where mm-hmm. he got an enormous amount of legislation done coming in 1933 as a result of you know, the Depression policies. But he had a, I think he had a 24-seat majority in the Senate and 170-seat majority in the House, something like that.
Yeah, it was
that.
Basically a super majority, essentially, at that time.
Astronomical by today's standards.
Yeah, never happened again.
We're getting now, we're getting like 50-50 Senate, right. 51-49, right. and right. 10, 15, 20-seat yeah. majorities in the House. So the 100-day sprint and the massive legislation every week just isn't going to happen. You've got to work really hard to get one significant piece of signature legislation through in the first 6 months. And if you look back in the history of the last few presidents, a lot of them have struggled to do that. So 200 days is just more realistic in today's environment, given the wafer-thin margins in Congress and the size and scale of the legislation that's necessary. Mm-hmm. So that's why the sort of 200 days is my primary focus. Mm-hmm. Get in, appoint a lot of the key people, and try and pass one piece of signature legislation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense instead of trying to do a bunch of things. Again, there are crisis moments or things that happen in the world where you sure. might yep. get a little bit more, but that's usually how it works. So the last question I have for you, I will not ask you to make predictions. I won't do that to you. But we are in an election year, 2024. For all intents and purposes, it's a rematch of 2020. You know, if you're objectively or kind of from the outside, just, you know, what would you be telling the candidates of in regards to this kind of structure here? It's like, look, here's year zero right now. We're a year away from the inauguration. What should the candidates be doing? You know, it's a little bit different because there's a former president against a current president. So, you know, there's a former president that was there not that long ago. And then you have the incumbent who, you know, that's a little bit different, I think, with a re-election as opposed to coming in there brand new. So it's a little bit actually kind of unique in that way, I guess, between the two candidates. But what would you be telling, you know, the candidates for the year zero this year? What should they be doing? What should they avoid? What, you know, big missteps? And again, in terms of organization or efficiency, regardless of what the election outcome is, just in general, what would that look like?
Well, you put your finger on it. I think this is the most fascinating year zero of all time.
It is a little. It's very unique. And, yeah, for sure.
And what are the things that might happen? You obviously have a possible President Trump second term, but discontinuous. Yep. You might have a President Biden second term, or you could have the sort of the unlikely but possible another Republican candidate, another Democrat candidate, mm-hmm. or a third party candidate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Third party's never won, but you know, strange things happen. and obviously, whilst it's most likely, as we sit here today, that it's President Trump versus President Biden, it's also not 100% on both cases.
No.
So the first thing I'd be saying is to the non-Trump Biden case, they better get ready. Mm-hmm. And if any of those scenarios happen, they will be out of the blue with less time to prepare. Mm-hmm. So we need to be ready in the small probability that happens or possibility that it happens. But if it happens, we better be ready for the implications of that. So there's a whole sort of cluster of thinking that needs to go on in those unlikely but really interesting cases. Mm. Then President Trump is really interesting as well because he comes in with the experience of 4 years. He'll probably bring some of his previous people in, but some new people. And when you look at it, he is much, much more organized this time
absolutely.
Around than he was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I fully agree with you on that. Absolutely.
The campaign has really been run in a highly organized, professional fashion. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of American First Policy Institute and Heritage Foundation, two think tanks mm-hmm. in DC that are doing a lot of preparatory work around policy and people, and a lot of their work would fit inside my sort of year zero framework that used different terms, I'm sure, but very similar in terms of the amount of preparedness they're doing. So they are doing a lot of the work that I would recommend they do. So that's and they come in with the experience of someone who's been there for 4 years. So that's super interesting. And then the last one is President Biden. And if he gets reelected, second terms, and you mentioned this earlier in the podcast, six terms is interesting. You would think they're just continuous, but they're not, because a lot of people turn over. They make it to the finish line of the first term and they say, that's it. You know, I've done
my best. Exhausted. I don't want to look at
it. I'm exhausted.
Right.
And then you've got the candidate, you know, President Biden. Okay, there's a lot, obviously, of his age, but he, in the next 12 months, if he was to be reelected, he needs to run the country and get reelected and put in place a new team and put in place a whole new lot of second term policies. That is a big ask.
A lot.
So
a lot.
The amount of work that needs to be done to get ready for a second term is less than a first term, but not that much less. And the world, as we know, is a pretty nasty place at the moment. So there's a lot of big issues that the current government is going to have to deal with over the next few months. So if he is reelected, his year zero planning is going to be unbelievably important for his second term. So in each one of the scenarios, I think they're fascinating in terms of their implications.
I fully agree with you, and it's going to be very.
And you put it all together, and this is going to be the most fascinating and interesting year zero. And the important thing is not just watching that unfold, but this is the next 4 years of our country's life that we're talking about. So we need to be ready.
Yeah, you said it. I mean, there's obviously the economic stuff and stuff here domestically, but which are obviously important. But I mean, there's a lot of things around the world that have either been very tense or are kind of playing out now. And there's all these things going on. And so that's also another thing to kind of keep an eye on. So good planning, good efficiency is important. Chris, this was so much fun. I was looking forward to the conversation. It definitely didn't disappoint for me. It was very illuminating. The book is great. People should go pick that up. And I'm so happy you came in and talked to me for, you know, an hour and a half or whatever. It was great. And we need more people like you that are very good on trying to have efficiency in our government and other places. So a big, big, big thanks for coming on and talking.
I really appreciate your interest. Thanks for
doing it. Absolutely.